That's what you've been waiting for.
All right, we can't play these songs all the way through because then that's all we would do today. And that would be a fine thing to do. As pretty much everybody knows by now, I think, Stephen Sondheim died Friday at the age of 91 at his home in Roxbury, Connecticut. And so there's sort of three types of relationships that people have with Sondheim. There are the first kind are the people who kind of know it all and know a couple of songs from Saturday Night, which was his mostly unproduced musical, which he wrote something like 70 years ago, maybe 65 years ago. And you know a couple of songs from Evening Primrose, and then you know pretty much the scores of everything. And then there are people who, they kind of know some Sondheim musicals, and, you know, they know Company or something. And then there are people who only know Send in the Clowns. And that's the only song they know. So most of our guests on the show today, probably all of our guests on the show today, are in that first category, people who have been so bewitched and entranced by Sondheim for all these many years that it's just impossible to imagine a world without him. So to help me along, help me through this process today, actually, before I introduce him, let me just tell you who else is coming. Coming along as we go, Florence Lacey. She is an actress and vocalist who has appeared on Broadway many times, including in the most recent Broadway production of Sondheim's Follies. Alexandra Petri, been with us many times before, columnist for The Washington Post, wrote an appreciation there for Sondheim. Gene Seymour, writer, professional spectator, he says, pop culture maven, he's always on our jazz show. He wrote an appreciation of Sondheim for CNN. And Howard Sherman, who is basically, I believe, the mayor of Broadway. I guess he's the deputy mayor of Broadway, and Lin-Manuel Miranda is the mayor. I don't know. We'll straighten all that out when we get to him. But joining us now, as we would have to have this be the case, is the man who is our guru about most things musical, Steve Metcalf, composer, musician, writer about music, teacher, thinker. I don't know. We'd be all here all day trying to figure out who exactly Steve Metcalf is, but he's certainly here right now. And welcome. We should probably say, Steve, that you and I have been having conversations about Stephen Sondheim for minimum 35 years, right?
Minimum. You left out Bon Vivant.
Bon Vivant, but yes. And so, you know, just maybe before we get in, what we're going to do is everybody's going to talk about one song, and Steve is going to stay here for the whole show, but he's going to do his one song coming up. But, you know, I don't know. One thing I was trying to think about today is there's a sense that when you first start really taking Sondheim's music in, even if you're pretty well steeped in the tradition of the Broadway musical, you feel like you're hearing something different, something that just isn't a logical next step from Cole Porter and Rodgers and Hammerstein and all that stuff, that it's something different or beyond that. I don't know. Are there some words you can put to that feeling?
Well, I think what you say is true, with the possible exception of Follies, which I think we should talk about in its own little subcategory. But I think, you know, the more that Sondheim revealed himself personally later in life in interviews, and I don't think he ever particularly intended to, but I think he became a little more, you know, sort of inadvertently revealing than perhaps he even meant to. It was pretty clear that he always intended to push those boundaries. He always intended to sort of go someplace with the next show that the previous show wouldn't have even remotely hinted at. And in the process, of course, ended up creating whatever it is, 12 or 15 shows that really in many ways are so different from each other that even though there's a kind of recognizable thumbprint, I think, DNA to all of them, that they really are just astoundingly unlike one another, you know, and I don't think you can say that about anybody else in the history of American theater.
So the most horrible thing you can do to a Sondheim fan is ask them to pick one song, but that's what I did to all five of you today, and I think we should get to yours because it's fun to play these songs here. So we're going to hear now Finishing the Hat from Sunday in the Park with George. We'll play, you know, a chunk of it, and then we'll come back and Steve will talk a little bit about it. So take it away, Kat.
Mademoiselles, you and me, pal, second bottle. Ah, she looks for me. Bonnet flapping, yapping, roof, chicken, pastry. Yes, she looks for me. Good. Let her look for me to tell me why she left me, as I always knew she would. I had thought she understood. They have never understood, and no reason that they should. But if anybody could. Finishing the hat. How you have to finish the hat. How you watch the rest of the world from a window while you finish the hat. Mapping out a sky. What you feel like planning a sky. What you feel when voices that come through the window go until they distance and die. Until there's nothing but sky. And how you're always turning back too late from the grass or the stick or the dog or the light. How the kind of woman willing to wait's not the kind that you want to find waiting to return you to the night. Dizzy from the height. Coming from the hat. Studying the hat.
So we're going to fade that down a little bit. That's obviously Mandy Patinkin. I hope I don't have to tell people that. Mandy Patinkin singing in the 1984 Broadway production of A Sunday in the Park with George. He's playing the painter George Seurat. Well, first of all, why'd you pick this one? There's so many things to choose from.
Well, I just thought, I don't intend to claim that this is the best Sondheim song. I don't think there is such a thing, and that's a pointless errand anyway. But I guess I felt like if somebody said, what is this Sondheim phenomenon all about? Why are people, if you wanted a window, to borrow an image from the song, into what Sondheim is all about and what his work is all about, I think this is probably as good a song to choose as any. And by the way, it's only like a 3 minute and 20 second song, and the first 30 or 40 seconds, as we just heard, are kind of the introductory verse. It slides into the, if we can even use the word chorus for a tune like this, it slides into it very imperceptibly about a quarter of the way into the thing. So it's really only about 2 minutes and something of music. And yet I think it can be said that this really does represent the essence of what Sondheim's genius is all about.
One thing that it doesn't have so much of is, there's so many things that Sondheim is known for. What it doesn't have are those very, very tricky rhyme schemes, interior rhymes or moments where, a word is used twice in different ways. There's less of that, and it really is almost a very earnest description by the character of what it's like to try to be creative.
Well, that's right. Although it's not quite true, I would say that it doesn't have the, let's call it wordplay that he was famous for. There is a kind of obsessiveness about this tune that I love. You actually brought the volume down just at the moment where he's saying, coming from the hat, studying the hat, entering the world of the hat, reaching through the world of the hat, like a window, back to this one from that. First of all, this, like so many Sondheim tunes, this doesn't sound like what we think of as a show tune. This sounds like an art song, not to sound pretentious here, but, it sounds like a statement of, kind of artistic purpose that is nothing like what I think most people mean when they say show tune.
Right. And there is a way in which I think anybody who's ever been involved, well, in not just creative tasks, but all kinds of things that you pour your passion into, it really does sort of capture a little bit of the idea of the sunny day where other people are out doing other stuff, you know, and you can't go there because you've got to do this. You've got to stay at the keyboard, at the typewriter, at the canvas, whatever it is. You've got to stay there and do that. And I think anybody who's ever worked on anything like that can sort of identify with
right.
what he's...
And I think over the years, a lot of people have kind of glibly said, well, you know, not only this song, but that whole show is kind of Sondheim's personal statement about what it means and what it feels like to be an artist and the struggle and the sacrifice that come with it. Except I think... as glib as it may be, I think there's actually a lot of truth to it, as evidenced by the fact that, as you know, the two kind of more or less autobiographical books that he brought out late in his life were called, respectively, Finishing the Hat and Look, I Made a Hat, which is another line from the tune, you know, to summarize in a way what his life, he felt, was all about. So I think the idea that Sondheim saw something of his own struggle in the story of George Surratt is you know, hard to argue with.
All right. We'll have Steve Metcalf here for the entire show. He's going to be talking with our other guests and offering observations here and there. But I want to bring in one of our other guests, Florence Lacey, Flo Lacey to us, an actress and vocalist who has appeared on Broadway many times, including in the most recent Broadway production of Sondheim's Follies. And elsewhere in theater, she's done other Sondheim shows. I believe she's been Desiree in A Little Night Music twice. I couldn't resist having her on. First of all, Flo, welcome back to our show. I think you've been on once before, right? And we might not quite have her yet. I'll tell you what we'll do. While we figure out where Flo is and how to get her volume up, let's play the song that she picked out. So the song that she picked out is, in fact, a song that she sang on Broadway. She went into the production of Follies, replacing Elaine Page, who you're going to hear sing this song. The song is I'm Still Here.
Good times, bum times, I've seen them all, my dear. I'm still here. Plush velvet sometimes, sometimes just pretzels and beer. But I'm here. I've stuffed the dailies in my shoes, strummed ukuleles, sung the blues, seen all my dreams disappear, but I'm here. I've slept in shanties, guest of the WPA, but I'm here. Danced in my scanties, $3 a night was the pay, but I'm here. I've stood on bread lines with the best, watched while the headlines did the rest. In the depression was I depressed, nowhere near. I met a big financier, ha, and I'm here. I've been through Gandhi, Windsor, and Wally's affair, and I'm here. Amos and Andy, Mahjong and platinum hair, and I'm here. I got through Amy's Irish Rose, 5 Dion babies, Major Bose, and the BBGBs for BB's Bathysphere. I lived through Shirley Temple, and I'm here. I've gotten through Herbert Jagger. When you've been through Herbert and Jagger, anything else your laugh. I've been through Reno, I've been through Beverly Hills, and I'm here. Reefers, Reno, rescues, religion, and pills, but I'm here. Been called a pinko, commie too.
All right, so we're having a little problem with Flo Lacey's phone connection, which may mean Metcalf and I will be discussing this one as well. Steve, one thing that I'm noticing here is that one thing that Sondheim did a few times, maybe a lot of times, as shows were revived and restaged, was redo them a little bit. I mean, if you know the lyrics from maybe the original production of Follies, these are different, right?
Oh, yeah, and that's not only true of Follies, of course, but I do, as I was listening to that tune, I thought of a thing that I think you and I have talked about, and that is, you know, Follies is really an interesting show in a lot of ways. And I think, for me, I've always kind of felt in some way that Follies, to some extent, was Sondheim's way of saying, hey, you don't think I can write hummable tunes? You don't think I can write a toe tapper, you know, in the old style? Here's a show virtually full of them, and of course some of them have become great standards and beloved tunes in their own right. But I mean, I think there's a sense in which Sondheim was trying to kind of work something out. He didn't do it ever again, but even although that was a relatively early show in his career, and I think was the one that came right after Company, you know, he was already suffering this charge from critics and audiences that it just wasn't like, well, these aren't the kind of tunes that we expect to find in a Broadway show. And this was, to some extent, his reply was, I can do that. Just that's not where my muse is taking me, but let me just at least demonstrate, to get this out of the way, that I can do that. And so, you know, Beautiful Girls, and you know,
maybe even Losing My Mind, this
Losing My Mind,
Broadway Baby,
you know, stuff. I can write show tunes with the best of them, which he obviously could. And I feel like there was some element there that he was trying to work that out and demonstrate that to people.
Right. It's sort of, this is a sort of interesting song too, because I mean, it works within the context of the show. It's one of the handful of Sondheim show songs that have kind of crossed over out of their musicals. And now, I mean, I always love it when like some 37-year-old singer gets up in a cabaret setting or something and sings this song like she's really been through the mill or something. But, you know, I mean, Carol Burnett or somebody like that. Not that Carol Burnett has really had a lot of bum times, but, you know, somebody like that can do it in a concert setting and it works in its own way, because
she did a great version of it in that concert version.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the what you're saying is true in two different ways. It's Sondheim saying to the world, yeah, of course I could write that kind of song. It just has to make sense, you know, for me to write that kind of song. But when you write that kind of song, you suddenly got a song that maybe people can do, you know, people can do outside the setting of the show you wrote it for. It has a little bit more transferability. But I would agree. I mean, you and I were talking about this yesterday. You know, I don't think he would have written Broadway Baby under any other circumstances. I mean, not that it's not a good song. It's just like, it's just not something he would necessarily turn his talents to, right?
Nor do I think he would ever overtly say, hey, I was just bugged because people were accusing me of not being able to do this. And so I just wanted to sort of put it out there that I have those chops, just in case anybody's wondering.
So I think what we're going to do now is take a break. We have not been able to solve the problem of Flo Lacey's phone connection, because we barely know how phones work anymore. We've been doing Zoom for so long during the pandemic. But when we come back, we're going to talk more with Steve Metcalf, Alexandra Petri, Gene Seymour, Howard Sherman. They'll all be joining us.
First a witch, then a child, then a prince, then a moment. Who can live in the woods? And to get what you wish, only just for a moment, these are dangerous woods. Let the moment go, don't forget it for a moment though. Just remembering you've had an ad when you're back to ore makes the ore mean more than...
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speakerseries.
When I was 19, I read the lyrics of Putting It Together to my mother to say that this is what I wanted to do with my life, even though I had no idea of what this might be. I couldn't sing like Mandy Patinkin. I couldn't compose like Sondheim. I couldn't write or direct like James Lapine. But like Seurat's Hat, that play was a window from this world to that. And I will always be grateful to you for laying out the desire and the beauty of the act of creation itself, regardless of where that may take you.
When I read that, I was touched, and I'm touched again. Thank you.
For the rest of my life. Thank you.
Bit by bit, putting it together. Piece by piece, only way to make a work of art. Every moment makes a contribution, every little detail plays a part. Having just the vision's no solution, everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts.
The board of the foundation is meeting next week.
Ounce by ounce, putting it together.
You'll come to lunch.
That, of course, well, first of all, you heard Stephen Colbert and Stephen Sondheim at the beginning there, and that's the song that both they and Steve Metcalf were talking about before. Putting It Together is, you know, often really sort of singled out from Sunday in the Park with George as really a description of what it's like to try to get something, make something work, you know, whether it's whether it's a public radio show or a Broadway musical or a piece of art. So joining us now is Alexandra Petri, a columnist for The Washington Post, very, very funny writer who's been with us many times before, usually to talk about vexillology or something like that. She's also the author of Nothing Is Wrong and Here Is Why, or to talk about puns, which are probably will be a little bit more relevant as we go along here. But, you know, I have to say, I mean, I don't know you well. I know you by reading your work and having you on the show. I wouldn't have necessarily guessed that you were such a Sondheimophile until I read the piece that you wrote. Maybe just sort of tell us, like, you know, what's your relationship with all this stuff?
Well, I feel like I'm a big theater geek, which is something that I feel like anyone who lives with me knows because of I'm constantly hijacking the musical selections and, you know, along with Assassins in the Shower and that sort of thing.
we should say Assassins is a play. That's not something that Alexander's doing in the shower with actual assassins. Anyway, continue.
No, exactly. I'm going to the Lordy, the original unset version. I'm doing the version that Sondheim has thoughtfully set to music. I'm a huge musical theater nut. And actually, like, I've been slowly working on writing a musical for years. So I am a big appreciator of it. And I feel like there's this thing Virginia Woolf said about Proust, where she's like, when you read him, you're sort of depressed because you're like, well, I can never write anything like that. And that's sort of how Sondheim is, because everything he does is so great and so perfect. And so, like, I almost, well, I'm more into junkier musicals usually, because I'm like, well, oh, like, you know, no offense to everyone who created Jekyll and Hyde, but like, I could do that. I could probably write a musical like that. But sometimes you're just like, oh, this is like so deep and it's so funny. And like, he can really do everything with words. So it's both like I feel like I had to sort of start on him like a little bit later in life. Although West Side Story was the first musical I ever loved, now that I'm thinking back on it. Here's just a sort of, I'm going to divagate wildly and tell you all of my thoughts about musical theater. Like, the first musical I ever loved was Cats, which, you know, is on brand. I loved cats as a human being and like really was into felines as a concept. I was like a little kid and like Gus the theater cat like threw a flower into the audience and I caught it and I'm like, this is great, musical theater is the way. And then the next one was West Side Story, which is like actually a good musical in a way that Cats is definitely not. And
I'm glad you understand that now.
I do. Yeah, I feel like there's sort of this interesting porousness between like good and bad and beloved. And the neat thing about so many Sondheim musicals is they like, you hear the concept and you're like, well, this couldn't possibly be a good musical. And it's like, no, this is a great musical, actually.
Right. Well, actually, the song that we're going to play for you that you want to talk about is the ultimate example of this can't possibly be a good musical. And then it's a great musical. I do want to say also, apropos of you singing Assassins in the Shower, that for the last couple of hours before I came into the studio today, I kept turning to my dog, Declan, and singing, "You are probably the worst dog in Hartford." You can sort of plug these things into, you know, all kinds of situations. All right. So Alexandra, although she really, really, really was toying with the idea of one of the songs from Assassins, decided that she wanted to go for the for reasons that she'll explain after we play it with the song "A Little Priest." I should say, for people not familiar with Sweeney Todd, what's happening here is that Mrs. Lovett, who is running a very unsuccessful pie shop, has paired up with Sweeney Todd, who is a barber hell bent on revenge, and she's suggesting to him now how they might combine their talents so that, you know, he's going to produce a lot of dead bodies. She needs to produce a lot of meat pies. You can connect the dots. So here's the song, "A Little Priest."
Seems a downright shame.
Shame?
Seems an awful waste. Such a nice plump frame. What's his name as? Ad has. Nor he can't be traced. Business needs a lift. Debts to be erased. Think of it as thrift, as a gift, if you get my drift. No? Seems an awful waste. I mean, with the price of meat what it is, when you get it, if you get it.
Ha!
Good you got it. Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and a pie shop. Business never better, using only pussycats and toast. And a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
and a handy practical and not appropriate
waste.
As always. Mrs. Lovett, how I've lived without you all these years, I never know.
Think
how
about it,
electable.
Lots of other gentlemen will soon be cannon for a shame. Won't they think of
choice
all their
the sound of the world out there.
What, Mr. Todd? What, Mr. Todd? What is that sound?
Those crunching noises pervading the air.
Yes, Mr. Todd, yes, Mr. Todd, yes, all around.
It's man devouring man, my dear.
And who are we to deny it in here?
Ah, these are desperate times, Mrs. Lovett. And desperate measures must be taken.
Here we are now, hot out of the oven.
What is that?
It's priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh. So it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
Now you see, the trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
heavenly. Not as hearty as bishop, perhaps, but then not as bland as curate, either.
Good for business, too. Always leaves you wanting more. Trouble is, we only get it on Sundays. Lawyer's rather nice.
If it's for a price.
Order something else, though, to follow, since no one should swallow it twice.
It pains me to fade this before we get to the shepherd's pie peppered with actual shepherd, but time is pressing. You know, Steve, before we throw it back to Alexandra, you know, there's so many things in this song that are the things that we talk about when we talk about Sondheim, and I'm so glad we played the kind of lead in to the more familiar melody, because there's all this very melodic stuff going on and this really, you know, ferocious counterpoint going back and forth between the two singers. I mean, before you even get to the heart of the song, he's musically done a whole bunch of other things to you.
Yeah, well, of course, as has been pointed out many times, Sweeney is by far his most, as it were, operatic piece, and that's part and parcel of what you're just talking about. I mean, there's almost not any real distinction between the verse and the chorus, or the intro and the head of the song, you know, because it's all continuous, and that has led many of us over the years to wish he had sort of gone down that path a few more times in his career, but he didn't, and he has often said that he wasn't interested in opera per se, and to the extent that Sweeney seemed to resemble one, and of course nowadays is produced as often in opera houses as it is in music theater places, has taken its place in the repertoire as a, you know, as a modern opera.
So, Alexandra, you are, among other things, some kind of pun. You're also a cannibal. We should say that first. But you're, but you also, you've won these punning competitions, and I assume that's one of the reasons you're drawn to this. I mean, he doesn't exactly do puns, but there is, as Steve said, a tremendous amount of wordplay in this song.
No, exactly. I feel like I found it after selecting this as my favorite. There's this great McSweeney's piece by Orley Matlow that sort of sorts you according to your favorite Sondheim song. And it says, if A Little Priest is your favorite, you were on your college improv team, you own multiple t-shirts with puns on them, and you're not afraid to repeat a joke louder if nobody laughed the first time, which is a devastating and accurate read, except that I was not even on the college improv team. I was like in the audience shouting at it. So I have a boundless appreciation for puns. And I think the funny thing about this is, it's a really hard thing to pull off, this song, because it's not just people who, like, it's not a song that's sort of unaware of its own wit. It's two people who are, in the context of it, deliberately sort of cracking each other up with more and more egregious plays on words about, you know, devouring human flesh, the ultimate treat. And so it's a weird alchemy to pull off where, like, the audience is laughing at people who know they're being funny, which is really difficult. So they're like laughing to themselves, but you're also like, by the time you get to the politician, you're laughing even if you don't want to be. At least that's my experience with it. But I agree, like, the lead in, like, musically, because, you know, Sweeney Todd's all over the place with the sort of the tone where it's just, it's so heightened and it's so dramatic, and it's like you couldn't view it as a tragedy, but it's so big that it's almost like a horror spectacle where, like, how real are any of the feelings? Like, how chaotic is it? And that's a choice every production sort of makes differently. And so just leading into it, it's the two of them, like, the realization, I think, is almost the funniest part. Like, oh, that's what this song's going to be about. It's going to be, we're doing it. Like, the wonderful practicality that Mrs. Lovett has, starting with her first song, Worst Pies in London, where she's sitting there saying, well, you know, pussycats are very difficult to catch, gotcha, which is the reason I don't serve them here. Not like I have a moral objection to serving cats. It's just, I'm a woman alone with limited wind.
Yes. So, you know, we should say another thing about this, Steve, which is there's a lot of people who can't get past the premise of the musical. I mean, they just can't do it, even if they sit down and try to watch it. There's another group of people who, I think, as Alexandra is suggesting, maybe feel that way going in, and then they're just swept up, you know, in the humor of this song, or the pathos and beauty of some of the other songs. But, I mean, one thing that I'm always struck by is how many really gorgeous songs there are in this incredibly grim, horrifying musical. And Steve, I know, you know, we were talking yesterday about how Joanna, which is one of the really nice ballads from there, that's another song that kind of survives a little bit outside the musical, although I don't know if it makes full sense outside the musical.
Oh, I think it definitely is surviving now. And I think, it makes whatever sense you want it to make. It certainly doesn't have to refer back to the story any more than Pretty Women does. That's why I think it's become a pretty, you know, well-done, well-traveled piece outside the show. I think that's testimony to the, I don't know what, the universality or something of the tunes, that they don't have to have the show to have a meaning, even if the meaning isn't precisely what the show assigns to them, you know?
Yeah. In fact, Alexandra, I don't know if you've been watching the series The Morning Show, but there's a scene where there's a charity benefit and Billy Crudup, who plays a network executive, sings Not While I'm Around and beckons Jennifer Aniston over. Jennifer Aniston, it turns out, can kind of get through a song too, and they sing it as a duet, but it's really about, you know, it's about what it's about in that particular context. So these things, I guess they kind of are transferable.
But that's true. I mean, it's like, I'm unworthy of your love. Speaking of things that out of context are just, this is just a nice ballad and totally not about assassinating anyone at all. I think Sweeney also, you with Not While I'm Around, or even These Are My Friends. I mean, you could just sing it about your friends.
All right. I have to take a moment to digest that particular idea. But
As it were.
Yes. Hope you digest it well.
Yes. Alexandra Petri, as usual, a joy to have you with us. She's, of course, a columnist for The Washington Post, the author of Nothing Is Wrong and Here Is Why. She's going to work on a musical. Steve Metcalf and I and a third collaborator, Larry Bloom, did write and stage a musical. We can tell you, Alexandra, exactly how many years that will take off your life if you really go through with it.
Worth it, though, I hope.
Yeah. It's kind of a jump ball, actually, whether it's worth it or not. But thank you so much for joining us. I think what we'll do is we'll take a break right now. We're going to come back with our final two guests here. And we'll be back with first Gene Seymour and Howard Sherman after this break.
I was younger then. I saw everything. I was hidden all the time. It was easier to climb. I was younger then. I saw everything, where they came and where they went. I was part of the event. I was someone in the tree. I was younger then.
All right. Very quickly, I want to thank Kat Pastor. She's our technical producer, making it all happen, struggling with problems not of her invention today. And also Jonathan McPants, who helped me produce this show. I was yesterday, I fell in love with this idea, and I started bugging everybody about coming on. So we have to go swiftly now. We've got two guests in this segment, and I want to get to both of them and have no Matt Damon situations here. So Gene Seymour. First of all, Steve Metcalf still with us. Gene Seymour is a writer, professional spectator, pop culture maven, jazz geek. He's on our show every year for the Jazz Roundup and also with us for other reasons. He just wrote about Sondheim for CNN.com. Gene, welcome back to our airwaves.
Great to be back, Colin. Thank you.
Without further ado, I'm just going to send us right into the song that you picked out to do for us to do or to talk about, and that is Being Alive from Company. I believe we're going to hear the Dean Jones version from the original cast album, so to speak, and so here it goes.
Someone to hold you too close, someone to hurt you too deep. Someone to sit in your chair, to ruin your sleep.
That's true, but there's more than that.
Is that all you think there is to it?
You've got so many reasons for not being with someone, but Robert, you haven't one good reason for being alone.
Come on, you're onto something, Bobby. You're onto something.
Someone to need you too much. Someone to know you too well. someone to pull you up short, to put you through hell.
You see what you look for, you know.
You're not a kid anymore, Robbie. I don't think you'll ever be a kid.
Okay, I'm fading it in the interest of time, although there's like big upper octave payoffs that are coming. And it's probably worth, I should say first of all, that when I got the news that Sondheim had died, I rewatched Six by Sondheim on HBO Max, and when the footage of Dean Jones singing this song in the cast album recording session came up, I just started weeping uncontrollably. And we should also mention that this is actually the third song written to end Company. Hal Prince made Sondheim throw out two songs before that. One of them was Marry Me a Little, which has become a major Sondheim staple in the canon. But so, Gene, you know, we want everybody to read your terrific piece on CNN.com, but tell us why you picked this particular song for this particular conversation with me and Steve.
Well, one of the things I said in my piece is that it's becoming clear, it became clear even before he died, that Sondheim was very much working not just as in the tradition of great lyricists like Hart, Hammerstein, whatever, but also in the tradition of Shakespeare, a very humanistic tradition. And I've always thought that if there was any song of Sondheim's that was most like the To Be or Not to Be monologue from Hamlet, it was this one. Because much in the same way as that soliloquy, this song really goes through an emotional ringer, and it makes an active connection between being together and, as the title says, being alive. And the reason why I'm glad you picked the Dean Jones performance, is I don't need to tell you, is that that may be one of the very few, if not the only example of a show-stopping performance, Dean Jones's performance of this song, in which the show-stopping moment came not on stage and in a recording studio, because Jones had dropped out of the production before it actually premiered, I think, was because of he was going through serious marital difficulties, which I guess the song really kind of nailed him to the wall emotionally on this, and he left, but they insisted that he record this song, this particular song, with the cast album. And you know, you're not the only, who said you broke into tears upon watching that again. Imagine how he felt doing it, and you can see it on the screen. I mean,
And Steve, I'm sure you know that Sondheim said that Jones never sang the song that well, not even close. That somehow or other he understood the moment he was in there in the recording studio and just like turned it all loose. And Steve Metcalf, I think you can sort of, as Gene is saying, you can kind of see it on his face. And I think Sondheim said you can see him sweating this thing out as he sings it.
Well, of course, that documentary famous in its own right, and it's almost like a little adjunct to the show. I mean, it's got so many moments. First of all, Gene, how you doing?
Steve.
I thought your CNN thing likewise was brilliant, and
thank you.
I congratulate you. If you don't mind, can I pivot just for 1 second here while we have Gene, because he knows everything about everything?
Sure.
I have often felt, or I've long felt, that for some reason, jazz players tend not to tackle Sondheim tunes as often as they would, I don't know, a Rodgers and Hart tune or even a Beatles tune.
Yes.
And because I just don't know that world very well, I guess I don't necessarily understand why that's the case. Do you?
That's an excellent point. And I wondered that myself, because back in 2000, as part of the JVC Jazz Festival in New York, there was a tribute to Sondheim, a jazz tribute to Sondheim. And
nobody showed up.
Well, a lot of people showed up, but Jackie and Roy, people like that. I try to remember all the cast, everybody who was involved, but it was a range of singers. And a lot of these singers are just in awe of Sondheim, to the point where they didn't feel that they wanted to break the structure or the motifs of the songs themselves. In other words, they just thought that trying to make them or trying to impose swing upon what they saw as delicate, as a kind of very delicate machinery, would throw the whole thing off. And so they were kind of at a remove from it. The only one who I think knocked it out of the park is this singer named Leah Delaria, who you may know better from Orange is the New Black. She played one of the inmates there. And she had done, you know, jazz versions of show tunes beforehand. But she did the main song from Sweeney Todd, Demon Barber.
Oh yeah,
and she kicked it, man. I was stunned, and she was the only one I remembered from that show.
Because, hey guys, I'm going to have to just jump in here because I screwed up the clock here. This is my fault, but we're so tight on time. I think we're going to have to say goodbye to Gene. We're going to get him back for our annual jazz review thing. Thanks for joining us, Howard Sherman. We're going to roll over now to Howard Sherman, theater administrator, writer, advocate. He's the U.S. columnist for The Stage newspaper of London and the author of Another Day's Begun, Thornton Wilder's Our Town in the 21st Century. We did a whole show with him about that. First of all, Howard, you should just tell us a little bit about yesterday. Yesterday, you were part of kind of a Broadway musical flash mob led by Lin-Manuel Miranda to sing Sunday in Times Square. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty extraordinary. And hi, Colin, and hi, Steve, and hi, Gene. Hey, happened yesterday was that actually an actor who people may know from Madam Secretary named Eric Bergen organized this gathering of people to sing Sunday at noon on a Sunday in Times Square. And I wasn't part of it. I was observing it. I was photographing it. But I know that since Friday, all I've wanted to do was be in a crowd of people and hear them singing that song and how wonderful that it happened. And even as I was busy taking photos and seeing what was going on, I sang along too.
Of course,
how do you not?
Exactly. We're gonna end the show today, by the way, with a little bit of that performance from yesterday. But right now, Howard has picked a song. I'm so happy. I think Steve is too. You picked something from Merrily We Roll Along. This is the song Our Time.
Something is stirring, shifting ground. It's just begun. Edges are blurring all around, and yesterday is done. Feel the flow, hear what's happening, we're what's happening. Don't you know?
Okay, I can't really let the song breathe because we don't have enough time. But so, Howard, just tell us why that's your choice. Why does this song speak to you?
Two reasons. One, when I was in college, my friends and I planned to see it on Christmas break, and it closed very rapidly, and so we could not see it. So it was the first Sondheim show that I was all ready to go to and just couldn't. And then I bought the disc, the vinyl album, about a year later, without having heard a note of the show, and just thinking, well, I should hear this. And in those pre-streaming days, and I bought it, and listening to that recording, if you knew nothing of the show's history, if you listen to that original cast recording from 1981, you just can't understand why that show didn't run forever. The score is gorgeous and stirring and beautiful, and everything people tell you Stephen Sondheim isn't. And I have to say, my favorite Sondheim show is Sweeney Todd. But in terms of pulling out songs, it's hard to pull out songs from Sweeney Todd. Pull out songs. There are a number of songs in Merrily We Roll Along that are just stunning and stand alone. And even though Steve said, you know, he didn't write songs to write songs, he wrote songs for musicals. He wasn't interested in simply writing songs, but writing songs for people, for characters. I think in some ways some of Merrily's songs stand alone most of all.
I think Steve and I both agree with you. I did essentially the same thing that you did, except rather than buy the disc, I borrowed Steve's copy and never gave it back. That original, it's been restaged a bunch of times, and there's this whole theory that it'll never work. I saw the Fiasco Theater's version of it in New York a few years ago, and actually I thought that one worked really, really well, but it is.
There was a British production directed by Maria Friedman that was stunning and emotional and moving, and it worked 100%.
All right, we're going to have to stop here. I want to thank Steve Metcalf for being my partner and buddy all the way through this, and to all of our wonderful guests, including Howard Sherman. But I'd like to end with a little bit of that concert that, or whatever you want to call it, that he was at yesterday in Times Square.